Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Johnston, and I am your host of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Today I have Dr. Justin O'Connor with me today, Professor of Cultural Economy at the University of South Australia. Today we'll be discussing his new book, Culture is Not an Industry, Reclaiming Art and Culture for the Common Good, published earlier this year by Manchester University Press. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And to begin with, Justin, if I may, what brought you to writing this book?
Well, I've been writing on this subject since the early 1990s. I lived in Manchester, I worked in Manchester, and the decade of the 80s and early 90s was very strong. Decade for music in the city, and I was very much into, you know, it was the new wave of Manchester music, the nightclubs, the Hacienda, Factory Records, very well known now, and I was very much involved in, if you like, trying to find out where all this energy of popular culture, loads of people around me doing all this amazing stuff, setting up little micro businesses, etc., how that might transform the city, because the city of Manchester used to be an industrial powerhouse, of course, and it had been really devastated in the 70s and 80s. So I was very much involved in the idea that culture, cultural industries, popular culture could transform a city. And so I worked on that for quite some time, a decade, more than a decade, very much an advocate for that. And I think from about 2004, 2005, I kind of began to move away from that and ask questions about it. And in some ways, this book is a bit of a mea culpa of these are the claims we were making, and there's some deeper problems there that I wanted to acknowledge and explore in some detail.
Yeah, I think that some of them were both political and economic. Is that accurate to say that those were some of the deeper insights that you provide through this book?
Yeah, in fact, political economy, maybe in the old term, you know, of that, which is, you know, how the economy hangs together with the political and social system, I suppose.
So the first question that I think that we need to discover is, what is culture? Could you give me somewhat of a description of what you would define to be culture?
We all know that it's a very, very difficult word, because it's being used in a range of different ways. I can't possibly give the full definition of it, because it's actually a historical definition. So the classic distinction of that we've more or less picked up is that between an anthropological view of culture, you know, culture is anything that is not nature. This is Edwin Tyler back in 1869. So, you know, we are cultural animals. We transmit our knowledge and our histories and through culture. We don't have instinct. So culture is all around us in that way and in that sense. And then there's a kind of narrower, if you like, or the more specific view of culture. Those are the kind of symbolic products and practices that we associate. We used to associate with the arts, the fine arts, but now that's a very large pool of things from, you know, the older arts, visual arts, music, performance, but also, you know, that wide area of popular culture, also digital culture, films, television, recorded music, video games, etc. So there's these two kind of definitions, and that's a very easy way to do it. And mostly we flip-flop between the two, and it's sometimes very difficult to know quite what we're talking about, because we say, you know, oh, well, culture, you know, the culture of the city, or the culture of a certain country, or culture of an organization, kind of a set of shared assumptions, a shared beliefs, shared practices. Or we might say you're uncultured, meaning, or that place is uncultured, meaning they've not got this art gallery, or they've not got any live music, or those kind of things. So the two definitions are in play. And I was very concerned not to get too much into that in this book. I wanted to make it as accessible as possible. But it's a very kind of complicated opposition, that one. And so maybe it might come out more in when we talk, some of the differences between them. One thing I wanted to make clear right at the beginning of the book and this podcast is there's often this idea that culture as everything, this culture as, you know, everyday life, let's say, is more democratic somehow than culture in this narrower sense of culture as a set of products. And I don't think that's the case. And I think that's been a very much a fad of the last 20, 30 years to see, oh, everyday life is culture. You know, it's people do it, everybody does it. Whereas this small and narrow view of culture is more elitist in some way. And I, as perhaps we'll come back to that later, but I think that's been a very debilitating approach to looking at what's at stake here.
Yeah, I think maybe we can start to ease into that as we start to talk about culture and where it can be found. You say everyday life, but then you also start to talk about how there are basically two types of culture at play, and I think it was maybe the organizational culture and then maybe societal culture. Maybe I understand it maybe from a more of a macro sense of culture, and then more meso and micro levels of culture as we get down to you know, call it a tribal level, and then smaller group level.
Well, I would start with the idea of a culture in modernity, and please don't ask me to define modernity, but it's some kind of level of complexity, divisions of labor, you know. And I think the idea of culture, I think, emerged quite late in the 18th century as a distinct area of life, separate from the economy, often, and separate from administration. And when I worked a lot on China, so when the Westerners, especially the British, arrived in China and in other countries as well, obviously India, but the idea that there was this separate realm called culture, something to be studied called Chinese culture, was alien to them, because what's culture was everything. But you know, China's a very complicated society, and bureaucracy and administrators and extensive markets and all those things we associate with modernity, but the belief systems were all wrapped up in those practices. So it's actually in Western modernity, let's say, that separates our culture as this distinct thing that we can point to. Culture, to some extent, can be found everywhere. Of course, we are symbolic animals. We work on meaning, and we pass our knowledge through, you know, through communication, whether that's voice or other kind of symbolic means. But we, in a modern complex society, there is no one fixed thing called culture, the culture of something or the culture of that. So actually we focus on much more complicated issues, and also the way in which those different cultures communicate or negotiate or contest other parts of those meanings that we have.
Yeah, and then there comes to be some degree of conflict even as these cultures are being made, right? So the right culture or wrong culture, or people who are cultured and those who are not. And that leads to that the industrialization of culture and some ways in which it's maybe resulted in culture becoming missing, something that was once there as a as an act of just participating collectively to this idea of industrialization, how it's become motivated through profit. Is that what you're getting at in the book about the disappearance of culture?
Well, I think there's a step before then. The I think what you talk about culture, culture is a way of life, or a collective culture. In that begins to break up. It very much begins to break up, certainly in Europe and in the West, if we like to say, from about the 16th, 17th century onwards. That culture that we now say, oh, it's collective and participatory, actually something like the church or the tradition, the aristocratic traditions of monarchy and country, these are what we would now call quite archaic traditions. And a lot of other forms of culture, especially we might call them the arts now, but arts and literature were directly to contest those older ideas of culture. And the power of that contestation that begin, well, I don't know where it begins, whether it's got Don Quixote or whatever, but the power of contestation of art and literature, that it begins to break up those established systems. And I think this is especially so at the end of the 18th century, when we get the Enlightenment in one way, but also very differently, the Romanticism. No, we are not going to accept tradition just because it's there, everybody does it. No, we can contest it with reason, or a bit later, by aesthetics, by emotion, by other forms of romantic tropes. So we've got this idea by the end of the 18th century of culture as a space, kind of autonomous, not completely, but kind of autonomous, where ideas, emotions, our collective values are kind of contested or discussed or negotiated in a separate space. And I would call that the public sphere in a way, after Habermas. So it's this public sphere of art and culture is something that's very much been with us for 200 years, 250 years maybe. And I think what you call the industrialization of culture begins when that system becomes absolutely dominated by companies seeking to profit from it. But I'm very clear that I'm not necessarily against that. Of course, much of the culture, art and literature from the 18th century was market culture. There were markets for books, so a lot of it was commodities, but it wasn't absolutely dominated by forms of profit. That really begins to happen when you call it the industrialization of culture. It's when it becomes mass produced, and it can only be mass produced when we have the technology to mass produce it. So of course, phonograms, records, earlier than that, lithographs, new forms of printing, of course, very important, new forms of mass publication, all the way through to television, and now, of course, recorded music, digital versions of that, film, of course, all the way through. This is when you can mass produce symbolic artifacts and make a lot of money. You can make a lot big losses, but you can make a lot of money from that. So this is when this is the idea of the culture industry, which was always been a conundrum from the 50s and 60s onwards. What do we do with this? How do we respond to this?
But now I do see the importance of modernity in there, because it first requires people to be able to break away from religion and theology and to be able to be self-thinkers, and the importance of the Enlightenment, the importance of the printing press, and to be able to create knowledge rather than rely on others for religious knowledge.
Yes, I mean the Enlightenment, but also and I would hold also to the Romantic period as well, which gives the Enlightenment, it's not entirely this kind of narrow reason, but Romanticism brought also different ideas to that Enlightenment, extended many of its ideas really. So we've got emotions, feelings, very subjective impulses and desires that's suddenly there in the public sphere as well. You know, obviously Goethe and young Bertha starts it off, but so they're in the public sphere, and it allows us to talk about our collective life in a certain kind of way. And as I say, these are often outside the power of state and church, if you like to call it that, and therefore they're somehow linked to the market in some way, but they're not dominated by the market in any way at all. It's that market dominance begins with the big industrial production of culture, which is basically the beginning of the 20th century.
So do you think that there was a divide between necessity and luxury even during modernity that then intensified potentially then with the industrialization of culture, or a culture industry where culture is mass produced? Do you think that it was not necessarily going from nothing, but instead going from slight forms of a hierarchy to a very rigid one?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of necessity and luxury, that's a chapter in one of the books, and it again, especially in from the 18th century onwards, it seemed that art was a luxury. It's what was consumed by gentlemen, gentlewomen, gradually, you know. It's something that, remember, liberal arts was the arts that were enjoyed by those who were free, you know, free to enjoy them, liberal, you know, in that sense. So, it, you know, the idea that the working classes, or even, God forbid, you know, the colonial classes would have the time and the intellect to appreciate great works of art, you know, was not unthinkable. But so there was this idea that art was about a certain kind of luxury. It was a certain what you did after your labor was done, and that's been a strong strand. And of course, it's used to critique the high art or whatever elitist art ever since, you know. But I wanted to say, well, that's not quite true at all. Of course, there has been that strand in it, but there is another strand in which, of course, culture, arts, culture, the production of symbolic forms, if you like, in a certain heightened way, is always part of what humans have been. And I try to argue, you know, go back to the very beginnings of humanity. You know, I'm living in Australia, you know, 60,000 years ago, they were writing, the indigenous peoples were drawing very elaborate rock carvings. Of course, we know in the caves of southern Europe, but elsewhere, there's this production of symbolic forms that seem coterminous with Homo sapiens. As somebody even said, the Neanderthals were also symbolic figures. I don't know. So this idea that we need to express ourselves symbolically, and that somehow this is about metaphor, it's about imagination, you know, this picture represents this. This picture will do this. You know, these are very long-standing forms. They're recognizable in all forms of human civilization. So, of course, in some ways, art is not a luxury. It's part of what we do. And I think, I say in the book, somebody who does not, no matter how much their life is marked by drudgery, and you think of the slave plantations in, you know, in Southern America, et cetera, et cetera, they find a way to express themselves in this heightened emotional symbolic way. And anybody who did not do that, we would consider as voided their own humanity in that way. So we call between, on the one hand, you know, somebody with a perfume wig playing a harpsichord, and then, you know, people who are living lives of absolute misery and drudgery who are forced to express themselves. So art is... I would say it's a necessity, but it's a certain kind of necessity that's not about instinct. It's not about being forced to do something. It's something that absolutely expresses our freedom.
In some ways, maybe the high culture and low culture dichotomy that was presented in sociology, or the idea of a cultural omnivore, and maybe that's not maybe neither of those really get at it as much as it is like human to do culture, and to not do culture would be to not be human.
Yeah, I mean the cultural omnivore one, it was something that emerged in the 90s, really, and so from around cultural sociology, and it was that, of course, you know, we sociologists of culture all read Bourdieu, and Bourdieu obviously based in France, doing his, a lot, most of his field work really in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, Distinction was published in French in 74, I think. A decade later in English. But, you know, and he described a situation of, you know, the working classes, the commercial middle classes, the more intellectual middle classes, and, you know, quite a convincing schema. And it was very French for a start, I would say. But clearly by the 80s and 90s, the explosion of popular culture and the way in which, if you like, the middle classes really picked up and ran with this popular culture was quite extraordinary and was very much missed by Bourdieu. So in the 90s, you got, you know, it was became fashionable among the certain kind of academic and middle classes. You know, you go to the ball game, you listen to, you know, Bruce Springsteen or whatever, as well as you can also appreciate a great literature, and maybe if you did that at college and things like that. So there was this idea that social distinctions were no longer so neatly mapped onto different kinds of culture, and that's kind of true in some ways. In other ways, perhaps not so. You find that the omnivores, those who like high and low, were a certain kind of person, class, if you like, middle class, whereas if you like the working classes or the lower classes, if you like, were very much, you know, they weren't able to take up this omnivore thing because they didn't have that kind of college education that is often required to do it. But I think it's from that decade that you asked about what are we losing in culture. It's from that decade, I think, certainly from the 80s and certainly in the 90s, that although the industrialization of culture, the, you know, commercial culture had been around, as I say, since the end of the 19th century and before in small scales, now it was that public policy itself at the highest levels decided, well, actually, culture is not this kind of complex mess of things that we are important for modern social democratic or social liberal societies. It's actually a consumer economy. And the state that should step back. We, you know, a little bit of education, a little bit of market failure, you know, for symphony orchestras and opera, but mostly it's a private consumer economy. Let it rip, and that's the kind of approach that led to the idea of creative industries and those other kind of things that I talk about in the book.
And did it become popularized? And this was focused on Manchester and the book. Is the setting in England, or where would you say that the setting for this book is mostly?
The setting is, I would say, the story begins in England, just because I tell that story, yeah, and to some extent in Manchester, and it's about how in the 1998 the new Labour government, the UK Labour government, which had come into power after 18 years of the Conservatives, they came kind of with a new agenda, a new kind of aura of, right, we're the modernising party, we're no longer the old socialist trade union party, you know, men in big jackets going on strike. No, we're a modern party. And part of that was their embrace of popular culture, because, of course, England under Margaret Thatcher had a renaissance of kind of popular culture, especially around music, but also fashion and a whole range of other things. And so they embraced that. And they saw this as a powerful modernizing force, and they call it the creative industries. But the word cultural industries had been around for a bit, but creative industries kind of linked it to what was going on in the States, in Silicon Valley, you know, the dot-com era, where all the, you know, entrepreneurs and startups and micro businesses were changing the world. And, you know, we were going to do that in culture. And it's all about these, you know, small businesses. It wasn't about big corporations. It was these small businesses, grassroots, bottom up, driven by entrepreneurs, but creative entrepreneurs, people who could appreciate culture and business and kind of combine them in some ways. So the creative industry, really, creative industries idea expressed a lot of this. And it was meant to provide jobs to replace the ones that the UK had lost in from industry. So Gordon Brown introduced that document in 1998. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he said, we're going to be the new creative workshop of the world. And so it was meant for the UK, possibly also for Europe or the West. But it was perhaps one of the new UK New Labour's most impressive exports, because it really ripped through Northern Europe. It really picked it up, but also very quickly in Shanghai, Singapore, Taiwan, the Far East. And then after that, very much picked up by the new Eastern Europe, the ex-communist countries in Eastern Europe. By the 2010, many African countries said, oh yeah, let's have a creative economy. It became quite a global phenomenon, this idea that culture was an industry that could help us develop, could help us modernize, could help us develop new kinds of industries based on intellectual property and creativity. So it was a strong modernizing idea coming from that original sense.
And that's why I started with the question of where the book was, you know, originated from, because I think it was that political force that allowed that created a groundwork or a foundation for such creative industry to exist and to grow in Europe. So that being said, do you think that these ideas can be, that culture can be found in built environment like infrastructure, and that the meanings that we make out of the built environment can also lead to, you know, culture being established? So I guess what's the relationship between culture and the built environment?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to talk a little bit about this in the book, I use the word infrastructure sometimes. I actually talk a little bit about that idea of infrastructure, but it's, I would say, you know, that theme has got stronger even since I've written the book. Now, the thing about infrastructure is that, which is a kind of a bit of a buzzword now, but both in the West, but also even in developing countries, infrastructure is, if you like, is the that which makes other things possible. And it's also that which is invisible, tends to be invisible. You know, you go to you go get some water, you don't think about reservoirs and pipes. You switch on your light, you don't think about electricity grid systems and things. It only becomes visible when it doesn't work, if you like. And that's good. So poor old engineers, nobody ever thinks about them until they mess up, you know, all their systems mess up. So cultural infrastructure, it was used to mean, you know, theatres and rehearsal space, you know, the physical space within which that happened. But it also was extended to include some kind of soft infrastructure, so some kind of knowledge or embedded knowledge, certain kind of relations in a space. And cities, many cities began to look at these things as assets in a way. And we get, round about the same time as the creative industries, we get the idea of the creative city. So here's cities that maybe they can use culture, art and culture in its widest sense, popular culture as well as high arts, if you like. They can use that to promote the city, to, you know, gain the tourist dollar in one way, but also inward investment, become a hip place, and also generate jobs around that. So the creative city almost at the same time as creative industries takes off, and the two things go together. And I think my concern with infrastructure now in the book and even just since is that it's now becoming visible because it's not working. And one of the big criticisms of the Creative City, for instance, is that the main beneficiaries of it were not the artists and not even the creative companies, but real estate. And both in terms of building new places to live, you know, the housing boom that happened in many big cities, and also hospitality, retail, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got this huge growth in real estate industries in cities across the world. Driven by, you know, glut of finance capital. We know there's this huge amount of finance capital looking for profitability. It's flowing into cities, and art and culture, in its very broadest way, have been a flag saying, please come and invest in me. And they did. And so what we're seeing is now it's almost impossible in the music, for instance, in the music industry, you know, where do you rehearse? Where do you perform? And even now, where do you live? You know, so the built environment, just to go back to the original question, built environment is the context within how we live. It's part of our culture. It's part of our material culture. And in that smaller sense, in terms of the arts and culture, let's say, it's been crucial to allowing, you know, us to enjoy the city of small bookshops, independent galleries, little venues, spaces of where you just hang out, cafes, all those kind of smaller places. And it's these places that are beginning to disappear, almost like an ecosystem. Kind of, you notice insects are dying. Well, so are bookshops, so are small venues, et cetera, et cetera.
Which may lead to, I think, may lead to confusion when it becomes over, when there becomes multiple meetings or that overlap with one another, leading to maybe an anomic state of culture and what it is anymore, with this what once was invisible now made visible because it's not working like it's supposed to.
Yeah, very much. No, it's and people are talking about it now. I read all the time in the newspapers how it's impossible to be in a band. Musicians can't make work because, on the one hand, of course, Spotify has eaten their lunch. But the idea was always, oh, we'll get out there touring. But now it's really difficult to tour because of the cost of living, the cost of labor, the lack of venues, or the venues are charging high, a whole range of things, festivals falling over. But you could also say the same with publishing, the whole range of different small things that we used to take for granted as part of the small scale ecosystem of a city. These now are drying up as well. So
in a whole area of artificial intelligence, which may be your next a topic that somebody takes on next, and how that impacts culture.
Yeah, well, that I suppose that goes to the other end of things. So rather than the small scale local cultures where that we take it for granted. On the other hand, when we were first sold the creative industries, it was grassroots, bottom up, startups, micro enterprises, little networks of rhizomes and things. But in fact, it's quite clear now that the cultural sector is dominated by a few very, very big corporations, much more than back in the day. So, you know, back in the day it was EMI and the record companies. They were the man, you know. But they're quite quaint now compared to Amazon or Meta or, Enviva, and, you know, all these things. So 6 of the 10 largest corporations on the planet, in the top 10, 6 of them are involved in the production and distribution of culture. And so we've got this huge levels of concentration. There's a writer called Cory Doctorow who's really gone into this in some detail. Real monopolies going on. And it's not just at the big level. We're not talking just Taylor Swift and things, because it's actually goes down right to the very micro level, because of course these companies are in our ears, they're in our eyes, they're in our living rooms, that, you know, they are all pervasive. So we're in a situation also where we've got the culture which is being produced on a massive scale that's really out of our control, I think. And AI's one step further from that, of course. Again, because not only is it exploited, we've all read now, you know, it's using existing culture. It just scrapes that culture and makes something to come on order, I suppose. But also, the beneficiaries of those AI things are, again, even smaller than before. So we're getting not just in culture, I should say, also in other professions, legal professions, medical, paramedical professions, we're getting this decimation now of the middle classes, the professional middle classes, as they're eased out of their once quite nice jobs. They now are beginning to join the ranks of the precarious, if you like. So it's no longer the working class. It's no longer those forced out of manufacturing into services. Now it's the old professional middle class are being, large sections of them are being moved to more precarious employment.
And yeah, this sense of even with that mass consumption, right? And this having culture and the creative industry shove down our, without very much agency of our own, determining whether or not we are going to consume this or that, but instead being forced to consume.
Yeah. Yes, and by algorithm. And that's why, I mean, that's why the book is it's an attempt to say, we can't let this happen. We've got to rethink our approach to culture, that it can't just be seen as this pure consumer economy where, you know, let the market rip, if you like. Because, of course, first of all, they're not markets. Amazon doesn't run a market. People talk about neo-feudalism, that they own the domain, you know. So we've got some, it's not a free market anymore. It's just these large-scale incumbents who control access to selling. It's a monopsony and it's a monopoly. Access to selling, access to purchase. They own the IP on the algorithms, right down to the micro level. You know, it's a kind of winners takes all thing. So we've got culture being dominated by, as I say, not even by markets, but by private mega corporations, but not just by them. What I said is we've got to start seeing culture as part of the social service system, if you like, you know, alongside health, alongside education, alongside social services, alongside basic infrastructure. It's something essential to us. And it doesn't mean it all has to be provided by the state in that way, certainly not even in culture, but it means the state should take care of this. And really just stating that is for me was an important step. The state has a role to play in ensuring that culture is somehow still seen as a public good, and alongside these other public goods that we think are essential to a decent society.
A part of our physiological needs, if we were to tie it back to Maslow, right? An essential part of being human before we could ever think of, you know, self-actualization or something like that in psychology.
Yeah, I mean, I take a swipe at Maslow in the book, and certainly the way he's used in marketing, because I think that, you know, the top of the tree, self-actualization, I think that happens, you know, a million years ago. You know, I think we all self-actualize in that way, but I think it's more like what happens when you allow that cultural system to be absolutely dominated by the market, but by the imperatives of commercial capitalism, if you like, profitability, domination, monopoly. what happens to our culture when we allow that to take place? And I mean that in back to the both in the narrower sense of, you know, symbolic goods, as I say, the arts, popular culture, but also in the broader sense, because we now know what social media has done to our societies. You know, we know that we in the level of communications, you know, which is a kind of an adjunct to culture, the realm of communication, we've had a Gutenberg style revolution that's been dominated by a small group of billionaires in Northern California. What really have we allowed to happen? So I'm also beginning to kind of almost like Walter Benjamin, you know, pulling the
hand. Oh, yes.
Let's stop and look at this. We cannot give over culture in its entirety to the imperatives of commerce in that way. We need to start thinking, what's the public interest in this? What's the public good in this? And how do we organize it?
I have a student just today talking about her love for Fortnite, and she started off with a pregame, and she was very proud almost as to how much money she has invested in the game, $2,000 since first purchasing it, because it provides her a good time and maybe some sense of freedom, but without even being completely knowledgeable of how much the industry has control over her behavior on that game. And whether it's true pleasure, maybe that's more philosophical, but, you know, a true sense of, or an emerging, I guess, a cultural, a natural culture, emerging cultural delight or something that isn't controlled by industry.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, and it's important to say, you know, culture is, especially in modern times, it's going to be a vast, complicated a fusion of different, whole range of different things. You know, you just need to look, glimpse into that. So it's not about the state providing culture in any way, or less. Although, I've just read a very good book called The People's Republic of Walmart. And it's a nice book. And it basically makes the claim that, you know, always the idea is that the state can provide, you know, infrastructure, steel, water, electricity. Maybe, you know, that's kind of nobody, well, certainly not in Europe, and nobody would quibble with the state owning the water, the lib. But culture, no. And consumer goods, no, this is absolutely about the markets. But then they write, well, look at Walmart. I think, I don't know the figures, but they control some huge 60%, let's say, the retail trade in North America and elsewhere. And they're dealing with an inventory of millions of separate things. And yet they provide it. And within Walmart, although, of course, they're working on the market, but within Walmart, it's not a market, it's a planned economy. So hence their name. This is the People's Republic of Walmart. They managed to plan a consumer economy for a voracious set of consumers. They do it through, you know, computational management of supply chain, feedback loops, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I begin to say, well, why can't we do that for culture? It's not necessarily about giving it over to the absolute rapacious market. There are certain ways in which we might want to say, well, how do we manage this? That's a kind of a side thing, just to say that it's not impossible. But what I would more hold on to is the idea that holding culture as a space where we talk about these things, where we can start talk about Fortnite, where we can talk about what the impact of Netflix has been across a range of things, on our ability to produce new stuff, but also what gets produced and how do we get access to it, what gets seen, what do people need, i.e. education to see these things. There's a whole range of things in culture that we need to think about and discuss and have an argument about. And we cannot just say, oh, well, it's just consumers. They consume what they consume, and whatever gets the biggest aggregation is obviously the most popular and good for us. That's clearly not the case.
All right. What went through my head with that is just the idea of these, you know, comments, or being able to go online and for users to be able to say whether or not they would buy it again, or you know, complaints about the quality of the product. I don't think that that's the discussion that you mean. I think that there maybe needs to be a deeper discussion or a platform for something more than a comment that was written a couple of weeks after the product was purchased.
Yeah. No, it's a bad problem. Well, I mean, you know, we've got, for example, we've got this a big eulogy for creative industries, cultural products, and yet actual creative arts courses, if you want to call it that, you know, people doing film, TV, games, creative writing, all these people, all those at universities are being cut, but really, especially in the UK and Australia, these are being cut. They're saying, oh, they're not proper. We don't want people to do this. So there's this disastrous collapse of education in culture at its broadest, starting in primary schools, you know. So we've got this a population that's being de-educated in this area, and yet we're saying, oh, they're perfectly able to make these choices about things. So, you know, where's the education? The newspapers, you know, whether physical or online, newspapers and of course have had a major collapse over the last decade for all sorts of reasons. That they were, you know, we call them the fourth estate. They were right there at the beginning of modern liberal democracies, and we allow them to fall over just like that. You know, local newspapers disappear, or they just become a, you know, franchise, just repeat stuff provided by a center. So we've had a collapse of the communication sphere, collapse of old newspapers, collapse of education. How on earth do we think this, you know, that realm of culture is going to stay alive and active if without any kind of support or any kind of sense that we need to provide the basic infrastructures, the basic knowledge upon which people can then make their own choices?
I think maybe there's maybe a head towards maybe like YouTube and places like that where people are developing amateur news through their own channels, but have you explored, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, YouTube provides, I can, in a way, I can now make things and put it out there in a way absolutely impossible, even in the 90s, you know. Back in the 80s, it was you bought or copied some papers and you stapled them together, you know, those kind of things. And going into recording studio was like, ooh, you know. Now, of course, you can do it on this laptop and I can get it on Bandcamp or whatever tomorrow. So the people are being creative. The question is, who listens to it? Who gets to see it? And on what grounds do they get to see? So, I mean, I you know, it's where's the sphere in which these different things communicate and talk to each other? I mean, that's our question in politics, isn't it? Everybody's in their own microsphere. But it's the same in culture. How do people get to talk to people? It's okay doing a YouTube, and I can be very creative doing whatever. Can I make a living from it? Maybe I don't want to, but can I make a living? Very few people can. And in order to do so, they have to, you know, build up their audiences and things. And I have two children, and they talk about YouTubers. I've never heard of these people. I go on, you know, there's one guy who eats, I don't know, 10 tons of noodles every day, and he's extremely obese, you know, clinically overweight. Or there's people on the other, people who don't eat things on their own. You know, that what gets popular on YouTube and other platforms like that is, of course, you know, the extreme, the shocking, that my God, did he really do that? And oh, did he really say that? You know, it's these kind of things. Is that's not the same as the kind of the old public, or I say public, not necessarily just state broadcasting, but also that sense where there was a public, there were certain boundaries where you could, you know, you could work, but in some way it was for a public. These things now that we put out there are not for a public, they're for other people like me somewhere out there. And that's one of the problems, I think.
So popular culture is becoming less popular, and and there's no central location for a public knowledge, or that is to say a specific group of a specific population of people, like maybe the city town square used to be a place for people to gather and to gain important knowledge, or the I think of great good places and the coffee shop or the pub as a place to go for that public knowledge.
And then also when you look at when there are examples of a popular culture where it is a kind of a real public, a real collective. And I think about this in terms of sport, and I've got a friend who works a lot on this. So somewhere like in the UK, for instance, big turnouts, millions every weekend for soccer. In Australia, millions every weekend for the AFL, for their own version, footy they call it. So these are big popular things, and yet we know that they themselves they're also controlled by large investment corporations. I mean, what's happening in the European soccer field is incredible. So many the big clubs are being bought up by the Gulf States, some by hedge funds like Manchester United, owned by an American hedge fund. The Manchester City is owned by, I think it's Dubai, but they're owned. So there's this piling in of large amounts of money into what does exist with popular culture. And when they try to kind of fight back or something, it's been really difficult. So it's in one way, popular culture is celebrated. We all like popular culture, great, because it's full of emotions. People, whether that's a Taylor Swift concert or a football match, great, we all want that. But we absolutely want to control everything, all the money that's generated from it. We get to manipulate it as we want, whichever is going to increase, boost profits. And it's so popular culture is also being the control of a popular culture is being taken back in a big way. So it's popular culture barely exists at the level of small scale, house-made objects, maybe at the local city level. But once it gets to a certain level, yes, it's popular culture. It's popular. People are there buying it in some way or watching it, but they do not control it anymore.
Oh, I was thinking of the influencers that your children listen to, because nobody's ever heard those names before, even though they might be popular to a small group of people, and there's only a few a few global names out there that can be recognized from Tokyo to Los Angeles.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, and of course they get old and they never talk about those people anymore. But there's another group looking. It's incredible these, and they say, oh, we've got 5 million followers. And some of them are big business, of course, but it's there's no regulation over those things. There's no that obviously easy burnout. They're all burned out. Whether really has there been a study on who makes these money, what they need to do to make money? And some people are actually physically put their lives on the line to get the cash dollar.
I teach at a university that largely recruits from their sports, and I talk to students. I'm like, so these names that we know in the NFL today or the NBA, how many years do they have a name? And usually they, within a matter of a couple of years, they're forgotten about because of how quickly they move out of the industry with attrition rate in an NFL draft, an NBA draft that takes place once a year.
Well, that's right.
So, yeah, this has been a very good conversation, and I want to end with a slightly different question than what I normally do on my podcast, and really give you a chance to tell the audience what you'd like them to take away from this interview when going out to read your book.
I would just to think to try to think about culture as a more collective conversation, if you like, not things that we all have to look at, Michelangelo, Beethoven, etc. It's a collective conversation. And when we say something is good or something is better, we're not saying that. We're saying this is better than that, isn't it? So it's a collective conversation about what we value as humans. And so we need that conversation. We need that collective conversation. We need to be saying that's better than that, because we all make those judgments, but then justify it because of this, because I think this, because of that. And it's this collective conversation, which I would call culture. And we absolutely need that at the moment. So no more siloing of culture, no more siphoning off of everybody into their algorithmic little fragments. We need to a collective conversation. And in that, we need, therefore, collectively to say we need to provide that space for culture to thrive. And part of that is about seeing this as a public good, not just as a private consumption economy.
Excellent. Thank you again, Dr. O'Connor, for being part of this conversation today. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Again, this is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Have a great day.